You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where you are not broken. I'm your host, Justin Amlezeski, and the day is finally here. We are discussing Zack Snyder's Justice League on this podcast. Now, I want to be clear, this is not the Snyder series episode of the podcast. That will come later. We'll handle that later. This episode is the review we typically do of a movie after we see it. It's the first weekend after it's out. We talk about it. This movie came out on March 18th. We're recording this on the Sunday following. It's that typical one. In fact, I did something cool here, and I tried to assemble, not the Avengers, not the Justice League, but the team that reviewed Justice League, the theatrical cut, when it first came out. Unfortunately, Midsider Katrina wasn't able to make it. She wasn't able to watch the episode. You know, things have changed over the last how many years? 4 years at this point? 3 years at this point? 4 years, almost. Almost 4 years. That's crazy. Three and a half, about. So, she wasn't able to make it, but I was able to bring in the other panelists. So, let me introduce them. Joining me this trip, no longer from the woke capital of the world, because he did what I did and moved out of California, the voice of Trailer Takedown, Dan Hackney.
Hello. Yes, I, like many other people in the tech industry, I up and moved to Austin, Texas. Oh, I forgot. I should be really doing this episode wearing my cowboy hat.
It's audio, though, so you're okay. Just tell people you have a cowboy hat on.
In spirit, yes. I outed myself that I'm not wearing it.
Also joining me from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Well, just to be extra California, I did go surfing this morning, so trying to live up to the California expectations. You know, I can't wait to start talking about the Snyder Cut, but I wanted to let you know, Justin, boy, there were a lot of surfers out, a lot of folks on the beach, none of them wearing masks, so I'm wondering if we're going to have to break up the pepper spray like in Miami and start taking care of these crowds out in California.
Well, I was going to say, to make it relevant to the Snyder Cut, we did see Joker out in Miami without a mask on leading people in a riot. So we definitely live in a society right now. We definitely live in a society.
Ain't that the truth?
So let's get started. Let's get started talking about the Snyder Cut, about watching this movie. And when we do these reviews, especially these longer ones, I always like to ask people what their experiences were watching the movie. Like, what was it like for them? What's the deal? And for me, it was sort of very, very surreal, almost. I said this on a stream I just did for the Zack Snyder Bible, where I kind of didn't have a lot of emotional reaction leading up to it. Like, I should have been super excited, and I was on some level, but it was kind of like, is this actually happening? Are we actually going to see this? And I still haven't quite processed the movie, even though I've seen it twice, because it's sort of like, wait, this was the movie we were waiting for, and this is real, and this actually happened. And it's like, you know, I've got my tattoo now to commemorate it, and I've seen it, and I've thought about it, and it's sort of like, wow, like this actually happened. You know, Midsider Michael flew in, Daniel flew in, Elliot lives near me, so we all got together. We all watched it, and don't get me wrong, it's an amazing movie. It's an amazing movie. I mean, to let you know, Daniel thinks it's the best superhero movie ever made. He thinks it's by far better than Batman versus Superman. I tend to agree with him that it's better than Batman versus Superman. I don't know about Man of Steel. I love Man of Steel so much. But it's real. It's real. It's here. We've seen it. And it's almost like I don't need to say anything else. And there's a lot to say, and we'll get into it, but it's sort of like, wow, it's real. We watched it. That can't be taken away. Like, that is in itself, and that's where I want to start. I just want to start to say, that is in itself, in the year 2021, a major cultural victory. That a Zack Snyder movie we saw, And we were able to get it released, and it exists. That is like, to put it in objectivist terms, and this is relevant to what we're going to say, that is like, rather than the culture being controlled by the Banner in New York City in the Fountainhead, the culture got behind Howard Rourke. That is, it's huge. It's huge. It's huge.
Yeah, that was similar to my experience as well, just thinking, oh my gosh, I've waited for this for so long. I was certainly not as central to that movement as you were, Justin, but it just getting to see it, and even from the opening scene, seeing the difference between what a Snyder would do with a movie like that and what Whedon would do, from, you know, the first second to the end, I just realized, wow, this is different and this is special, and this was not at all guaranteed.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was surreal for me. I think, you know, harkening back to the original review that we did, if you remember, I was one of the people, I was like, the movie was all right. And I had kind of gone in with lower expectations, right? And I said, it was all right. And I think the reason, you know, now that I've experienced the more sort of integrated version, you can, you know, it's so easy to, it's so easy to see how something with the same skeleton can be filled in and integrated so much differently. And, which I'm sure we'll get into, but as far as like my experience of watching it, I purposely kind of broke it up into several viewings, you know, stopping at certain part markers and just kind of savoring it a bit. So, I think that one of the things that really stood out to me was how it is a long, you know, it's what, 4 hours and 10 minutes, something like that. But there was no point that I wanted to stop, right? If it wasn't for the little chapter markers, I probably would have just sat in all one viewing and not realized, oh, this was a part to take a break in, right?
Yeah, William, I mean, you speak to how phenomenally paced it is. I personally think it works well in two parts rather than six. It's like parts 1 through 4 work really well together, and then 5 and 6. And that's sort of just time-wise. I think that's like the halfway point of it. But still, the pacing of it is phenomenal. It's like you said, it does not feel like 4 hours. Especially because when we watched it for the first time, it was sort of like, paused it after an hour because of one of the title screens, and like we got pizza and we ate it all, so we all sort of cleaned up after, you know, about an hour. But it was almost like, and maybe it's because it was the first watching, that first hour felt as long as the other three. Like, it hummed along. And I feel like more than any of his other movies, this one built towards a crescendo in the final battle. Like, it all sort of paid off. You know, Batman versus Superman, the final battle kind of, like, went on a little bit. You know, Batman versus Superman, there's the crescendo of Batman versus Superman, and then it's like, oh, all of a sudden we got to fight Doomsday now. Man of Steel, it was sort of like, all right, now this is just sort of what has to happen because he has to fight Zod, and this is the way it is. Whereas the conflict was sort of resolved a little bit before that. You know, he was Superman. He had already decided to fight, and this is what he has to do. Whereas in this one, it all built towards it. It all built towards Cyborg's moment inside the mother boxes. It all built towards Superman showing up. It all built towards the Flash having his moment where he reversed time. Just the pacing was phenomenal.
Yeah, I had a similar thing where about an hour in, we took a break to, you know, eat some pizza and, go to the bathroom, whatever. And it sort of simultaneously felt like much more time had passed because it felt like so many things had gone on, and I was just really into it and enjoying it, but also that it just flew by. It was a weird feeling.
Yeah, also the beginning, I think, sort of was very much a lot of, like, transition from BVS. And it didn't really become its own movie until after the first part. You know, it was similar with BVS, right? At the beginning of that movie, you had the little bit of the opening, right? The fall of Batman and everything with the caves and the whole Plato's cave metaphor and everything, symbolism. And then it was, oh, here's how this movie overlaps with Man of Steel. Well, you had the start of this as well, where it was, oh, here's the overlap with Batman versus Superman, and we're going to look at that from a different angle, right? We looked at Superman versus Zod from a different angle, from Bruce Wayne's angle. Now, this one, we looked at the whole world's angle, because at that point of Batman versus Superman, it was just sort of Batman's angle, right? We had become Batman at that point, and we were seeing his view on the fight at the end and his view on Superman's death. Well, we saw the scream and how that affected the rest of the world. And then it was almost jarring to me when Cyborg was brought in. It was just like, here's all the world, you know, how this is responding to the scream. And then all of a sudden, there's Cyborg. And I was like, wait, what? He's in this? And it was at that point on, that first shot of Cyborg, where it was becoming a different movie. And then gradually that other movie was more, it was integrated more, moved away from Batman versus Superman more.
Became its own thing. But yeah, I really liked that. And looking back, both Batman v Superman and this, where you get much more of a sense of the previous actions tie over into this, and it shows you how they tie into the current one versus, I guess, what we've come to expect from Marvel movies is, oh yeah, there's some stuff that happened and we'll sort of assume you're caught up and know how everything fits together and go on from here. I guess that might be an artifact of having a bunch of different directors for each of the Marvel movies versus having Zack Snyder with a plan throughout all of these.
It's an artifact of that, and I think it's an artifact of TV streaming culture as well, where Marvel is very much, it's very apparent now after having watched this movie, Marvel is just television for the big screen. It's here's the next episode you're going to watch. And when you watch an episode, they'll like write very expositionally, oh, here's what happened in the last one. I mean, they used to do it back in the day on television where you come back from a commercial break and they'd say, remember what just happened before the commercial break where you punched me in the face? I'm mad about that, rather than showing the character be mad. Whereas here, it's made for the big screen. It's visual. So even though we're watching it on a small screen, it wasn't shot in the way a TV series was shot. It's not character talking to character. It's visual storytelling. And I mean, I don't know if I've heard anyone say this, not that I'm super plugged in, but I wonder, how long did this movie go without actual dialogue at the beginning?
Because it was gonna say that.
A long time with no dialogue.
Yeah, I really liked that.
Yeah, there was a lot. There's a lot of a lot of the scenes had room, like, really to breathe, right? Like, I don't think anything lingered so long that I noticed it, but after I got through the final scenes, in the post-credit scenes, I sort of sat back and thought, like, each one of these scenes, like, they were given space, right? Like, just think of the scene that comes to mind is the Alfred and Diana making tea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that definitely would have been cut from a theatrical film, right? But it talks about the characters, right? And it says something about Diana's character, says something about Alfred's character, and it's a moment that they have together, so that in future moments, it's not so jarring, which is one of the biggest criticisms we talked about of the Whedon cut, is that things sort of just happen, and then this happened, and then this happened, right? There's no sort of context or explanation on some of the events that happen, or some of the character relationships. You're just supposed to accept that these relationships have formed, right? But the little tea making reveals little things about the characters and shows that they are interacting, right? And serves that purpose of showing that these relationships are growing over the course of the film.
Well, that one was interesting also, Oh, because it shows, by implication, part of Alfred's relationship with Batman. That, you know, he's very careful to make the tea in a certain way, and he has a notion about how things are supposed to be done, and that doesn't come from nowhere.
100%, and that's part of the point of the movie, right? Is it's all about that team building. It's all about how do these disparate individuals come together. And to reinforce your point, William, it reminds me very much of Mad Men. Not to, you know, bring in a television show after I just dumped all over television, but you know, Mad Men's one of the best television shows ever because it gives the scenes time to breathe. It's showing you the lives of these people because ultimately the show is making a point about the lives of the people and how they live their lives and why they live them in that way. And you're right, these scenes were given time to breathe, but even when you're talking about that scene of making the tea, it's exactly what Dan just said. It was done in that way for a reason, to give you a point about the relationship between Diana and Alfred, but also about Bruce Wayne's expectations. And even though the scenes are given a space to breathe, everything in it is used economically. There's not wasted dialogue. This is not dialogue to be like, oh, we're going to naturalistically show these people having a conversation. We're not just going to have them have a normal conversation. Even the conversation with Joker and Batman at the end, it was very pointed. There was a point to each piece of dialogue. So that scene at the end was long and given room to breathe, but everything said in it had a reason for it. And I think that's one of the strengths of this movie, even more so than Batman versus Superman, where a lot of the scenes were sort of heavier. I didn't get the same sense of weight with all of these scenes. Not that there wasn't thematic depth to what was going on, but it wasn't heavy as far as like everything being sort of weighed down and slowed down. There was a good pace to this where it was left room to breathe, but also everything in it was done very economically.
Yeah, I had a couple of thoughts on the dialogue since we're talking about that in particular.
Yeah.
So, wow, was the dialogue different? And not that Whedon's a naturalistic when it comes to dialogue. If anything, he's highly stylized, right? It's very ping-pongy, right? Like, what keeps things moving in a Whedon movie is the dialogue, not necessarily the shot composition and things like that, right? It's more about the sort of the banter and the pacing. It's almost like a, I don't know, it's like a stage play almost or even maybe like an older film. I'm thinking of like His Girl Friday, right? Like that sort of dialogue. But so all of that is removed for the most part and replaced with this you know, more of Snyder's style of dialogue. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that changes the characters in ways that are, I think, important. Barry Allen is not a fucking annoying twit like he is in the Whedon cut, right?
He's a bit annoying.
Yeah, his jokes are gone, and what's left is a feeling that, hey, this is a awkward, maybe slightly autistic, you know, kid, right? Like, he comes across not as the annoying one, but like, oh, this is just a kid trying to, you know, make sense of this, right? Like, trying to be a part of this and having that wonder. And still slightly annoying, but slightly annoying because he's a kid, not because he's just fundamentally annoying. I don't know, what'd you think of that?
Annoying in an endearing way rather than an off-putting way.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Barry. And then, you know, that really plays into the whole, oh, Barry worships Superman thing. Like, that made sense. Whereas before, all the stuff you would say, like, the big difference with that when you talk about Barry is the brunch thing being gone, right? Versus the other things he said. He doesn't have these, like, kind of pretentious observations that, like, a teenager who thinks he's smarter than he is has. He has, like, witty quips where he's just sort of, like, observing what's going on. Like, one of the things that was in both was when they leave on the roof from Jim Gordon, he's like, well, they just do that really quickly. That's rude. That comes off more as, oh, hey, he's trying to figure out what's going on and he's observing it more than, oh, he's going to comment on it because he's so smart.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and also one thing I found interesting about the revised dialogue and stuff is most of them are much more, I guess you could say, serious and focused. Like, it's not all a big joke to them. like it was for a lot of them in the Whedon cut. And so the contrast between essentially all of them are warriors to some degree or another, except for the Flash. And you can really see how, in a way, out of place he is among these people who, you know, Batman's been doing this for 20 years. Wonder Woman's an Amazon warrior, Aquaman, Superman, Cyborg is a football player and has that mindset to some extent. And Barry is just so out of place in a way. And so I felt like
He's a nerd. He watches Rick and Morty.
Exactly. And so there were some parts where it felt like, wow, seems like his powers are really being underutilized because, wow, somebody that fast could, you know, just, you know, go and punch everybody, or like he should never be able to be hit by anything, but he is because he doesn't have the mindset that these other people do. If, you know, Batman had the kind of super speed that the Flash does, he would be much more effective because he has that more focused mindset.
Well, just kind of saw that, Dan, very much in the Superman fight where they revive Superman.
Yeah.
And then there's the one point where he's just, you know, he does what you do when you don't have control, right? He just starts running at him really fast. And it's like, you know that's going to end poorly. Like, think about that in like a wrestling standpoint, right? If you just dove at a guy or you just went as fast as you could at the guy, the other guy's just going to use your momentum against you. Like, that's just a basic move. And that's exactly what Superman does. And what happens because of it, he accidentally knocks over Aquaman, who gets really annoyed at him because he's the more experienced fighter and knows what the mistake that was made.
Yeah, yeah. And so I thought it did. That really only works when everybody else is, to different extents, like, focused and knows what they're doing and confident and competent. And here you have Barry Allen, who normally is able to rely on just, oh, I'm so fast and I can just kind of run at people and it'll kind of work out. And that doesn't work anymore.
Well, let's talk a little bit too, since we're talking about things that are done well. So I think the dialogue falls in that category. I think the action sequences for Batman are done much better and really resonate in this cut of the film. You know, it was fairly obvious in the Whedon cut which ones were the reshoots for Batman stuff. I feel like Batman was utilized a lot better, and it was much more focused, integrated. I know we haven't entered the theme discussion yet, but much more integrated with the theme. You know, he fits the role that he has on the team, but he's still able to, you know, kick some ass and have some exciting action scenes as well.
I thought all the action, and in contrast with a lot of Snyder's previous movies, you know, when I think of Watchmen or I think of the warehouse scene of Batman and Batman versus Superman, I thought a lot of the action was a lot more streamlined. This wasn't like a lot of hitting, a lot of punching. It was very purposeful shots that progressed the fight from one move to the next. You know, the sort of one really like hand-to-hand combat fight I can really think of is Steppenwolf and Wonder Woman, when Steppenwolf is like, she's mine, and Wonder Woman says, I belong to no one. That was a hand-to-hand fight. But even that led into the, if I remember correctly, Barry Allen touching the tip of the sword and pushing it back to Wonder Woman, right? Am I correct in that memory?
Yeah.
I believe so, yeah.
Right. So even that was purposeful. I thought the action was a lot more purposeful in this movie with the way it was shot, rather than having these hugely long fights. And we see in a lot of action movies nowadays these hugely long fights. And I think it sort of began in the Matrix sequels, where you would just have these huge fights that would go on. And at a certain point, you're like, there's not really anything going on in this fight. You're just showing people punching and kicking each other because you want to have a cool looking fight.
Yeah. And each of them, they move, the situation changes throughout the fights a lot. And I think that goes to what you were saying, that in the Matrix sequels in particular, you'd have one fight in one location with one set of circumstances that would just drag out. Whereas in this, they're evacuating the hostages and then in the tunnels and fighting Steppenwolf, and you know, it's these people, and then one person goes over here, and so you have it. I think that partly makes it interesting for longer, because it isn't just, again, people punching back and forth, standing in the same place for the whole time.
Well, right, that example you give of the hostages, right? We're talking in the beginning where the terrorists go into the bank. And Wonder Woman goes in there, and she has the hand-to-hand fight, and then she's blocking the bullets. There's two different segments to that fight. But all the punching and kicking in that first part is to disable each of those terrorists. And once they're disabled, that's it. You don't go back to more punching and kicking. Then you go to beating the main terrorist. And he has a gun, and he's going to shoot them. And she has to block all of them, and then she has to use her cuff smash, whatever it's called. I don't know. Some DC person can tell me what that's called. But then she has to use that to beat him. Oh, sorry, I forgot about the bomb in the middle of it. But the point is, I just did three different movements within that one fight sequence. It wasn't like she was punching and kicking those henchmen for a long time. It was just, got to eliminate the henchmen. Okay, they're gone. Got to get rid of the bomb. Okay, it's gone. Okay, got to get rid of this guy who's going to shoot all the hostages. Done. Moved on. We can move on with the scene. And not that it wasn't a joy to watch, and not that it was done too quickly, but it was paced perfectly, and it was choreographed to not be overdone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's move on here. I don't want to spend, like, this entire episode comparing to the Whedon cut. So what I would like to do is I'd like to talk about, well, what's the theme of the Snyder cut? What is this movie in particular about? Because this is definitely not about the same thing the Whedon cut's about. So let's move forward now. And I'm going to tell you all what I think the theme is. And then you can share if you had a similar idea or if you would change it at all. So I defined the theme as the strength of working together to protect and promote shared values. And the reason I defined that as the theme is what I love about this movie, and it was one of the biggest things I was worried about going in. There were two really big things I was going in, two things I was worried about going into this. The first is how the team was going to be brought together, and the second was Superman. And I'll talk about Superman in a second. This discussion will lead into the Superman discussion. But the first thing I was worried about was, in every movie in Hollywood, in every story, it's always putting your individuality aside in order to make the team better. We even see this when people are talking about sports, right? You can't be selfish on a team. You have to put aside your selfish values in order to achieve the team values, which to me is completely antithetical. If everyone shares the value of winning, if you do your job, to use the Bill Belichick quote, then you are being selfish. And what I loved about this movie is the point was, to work together in a team, you have to have a strong sense of self. You have to have a strong self-esteem. Otherwise, you aren't going to be able to work together properly because you're not going to be able to respect each other. I think we really saw that with Batman. The reason he's finally able to work together as a team is he has a benevolent sense of other people because of Superman, and because, you know, he saw who Superman was, and Superman became a symbol for him. And I think we saw that with other characters. I think it's very strongly with Cyborg's plot, where Cyborg at the end, you know, he gets pushed into the Unity, right? And this is the fake Unity, right? This is the evil Unity. This is the three mother boxes come together, and that's the Unity that's going to destroy the world. And he comes together in there, and the Unity tempts him. And the Unity says, we can give you everything you want. Here's your mother, here's your father, and here's yourself, not broken. Very much in the style of Xerxes, right? Xerxes tempting Ephialtes. You know, Ephialtes doesn't feel like he can contribute, that he's broken. So Xerxes promises him everything he wants without the work. But Cyborg says, I'm not broken. And that's what finally makes him able to contribute. He can finally contribute. He's finally part of this team. He's serving his purpose within this team. Right? I don't mean serve in the, you know, the sense of like, oh man, he's giving himself over. I mean, he's doing what he can. He's using his abilities to the best of his ability. And the same thing with Flash. Flash, right before he reverses time, what enables him to go faster than he's ever gone before is, he says, Dad, just know that whatever happens, your son did it. He was one of the best of the best. He found himself. He found that self-esteem. And that's how he was able to share values with the team, to contribute to the team. And I contrast that with Steppenwolf. Well, what is Steppenwolf asked to do? Again, just like Xerxes, Darkseid is a fascist ruler. And Steppenwolf has to bow before him. And Desaad even says it. The reason you have to keep bowing, the reason you have to pay this penance, the reason you have to prove yourself over and over again is your pride got in the way. You tried to go out on your own. You didn't just give yourself over to Darkseid. Well, now you have to. Who you are doesn't matter. Your self-pride doesn't matter. You have to give yourself over to the great darkness. So that's why I saw the theme as I saw it. Those are sort of my opening thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way of summing up the theme. You're always a lot better at identifying and describing a theme concisely than I ever am. And I think you're, in particular, the point about Steppenwolf and Darkseid is very well taken, because especially with Darkseid looking for the anti-life equation, and the use of the mother boxes was to rob people on the planets that he had conquered of their individuality and
free will.
Free will, that's it. Yeah, thank you.
Doesn't Steppenwolf say that at one point? We must take their free will from them?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. And that, in particular, there's Darkseid has some lines about contrasting anti-life as being anti-free will, and that's what he's seeking to do, is in some way free people from the burden of having free will. Doesn't quite, you know, he's only very briefly in it, but it's a lot of that idea of, yeah, that sort of enlighten them to a new level where they get to give up their free will. And so you contrast that to the heroes, which, yeah, in a way they're joining a group, but it's not a renunciation of their free will and reason and individuality, but the ultimate achievement of it. To work together.
And I'll throw this to William here. William, even with the terrorists at the beginning, they make reference to that, right? Where they say the reason we're doing this, we're not robbing a bank or anything. We're going to explode this bank because down with the modern age and back to the dark ages.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good contrast with what Darkseid wants to do, right? That there are people out there, and then getting back to the theme, you know, that is important because it goes back to Bruce Wayne talking about his sort of faith in humanity, right? And back in Man of Steel in Justice League, Justin, I'm curious, you know, he says faith a bunch, Bruce does, in
yeah, this. I noticed that.
And, you know, for me, it's, I almost wish there was a different word, because it's sort of meaning this sort of benevolence or fealty, not fealty in the sort of like, or maybe fidelity, right? Like this, the sort of like benevolent, you know, belief in that free people, you know, that people, individuals, that there are good individuals out in the world, right? And I don't know if faith is the right word for what Bruce is describing in all of those instances, right? He's talking about, and I think the one in particular, he's having a conversation with Alfred, and says something like, well, you know, all reason says this won't work, or something like that. And he's like, well, you know, I'm going on faith. And I don't think he literally means I'm going on like irrational belief, right? He's sort of saying I'm believing in this group that we have made, right? I'm believing in that the parts are larger than just the sum alone, right, of the individuals that are in this group. What do you think about that, Justin?
I was hoping we would get to that next, so I'm going to put a pin in it for a second. I think you've raised an excellent point, and I sort of wanted to do like objectivist questions at the end. So there's one thing I want to touch on before we get to that, and then we'll loop back to that. What I wanted to get to sort of lead into that is Superman. And let's just talk about Superman's journey a little bit, because I think it directly informs your question, William.
Okay.
It directly informs your question. And what I mean by that is the second thing I was worried about with watching this movie was, and it was the thing I was going to be worried about throughout Zack Snyder's entire story here, was going away from individualistic Superman. And what I mean by that is Snyder always said he was going to evolve into Superman. And the Superman we all know. Well, the Superman people know in our culture is altruistic Superman, right? Being concerned with the others. Being concerned with other people primarily beyond himself. And what we saw in Batman versus Superman was, you know, he finally realized who he was. And he died because he was willing to fight for his values. His big moment in Batman versus Superman was, this is my world. You are my world. This is my world. You are my world, right? That was his big moment. And it was about his values and fighting for his values. Wasn't really sure about being a symbol. Well, I think the same thing is true in this movie. I think all of the characters are concerned with how they're going to be seen by other people. You know, we see Darkseid. We see Steppenwolf. He's worried about how Darkseid sees him. We see Cyborg. He's worried about how other people see him, right? He doesn't want to be seen as a monster. Barry Allen is he doesn't see himself as worthwhile. He doesn't think anyone sees him as worthwhile. But then at the end, when they stop worrying about that, same thing with Aquaman, right? Aquaman is worried, how is he going to be seen by the surface and how is he going to be seen by Atlanteans? He's stuck in between two worlds. But when he goes beyond that, when he gets past that, he's able to work together with the team. And I think we see that very strongly when Superman's brought back, and it alleviates my concern. Because when Superman is brought back, they have the big fight in Heroes Park where they can't get through to him. And he's about to basically toast Batman. And I mean that very literally, right? He's his eye rays are warming up. And Batman's like, no, Superman, don't do it. The world needs you. And Dan, does him saying the world needs you stop Superman?
Not at all.
No, what stops him?
Lois. Seeing something that
and
he
then
needs.
What does he do? Right, he needs, he wants, it's his world. Then what does he do? He goes home. And by going home and finding what he loves and what his life is about, he comes back. That's when he's finally himself again. That's when Lois is finally says, he's back. And then he puts on the black suit. And he flies off. And he's no longer a symbol. Right, he's not the Superman we all know. He's no longer a symbol. He's not the Superman we all know that stands for something. That stands for something. Then he goes and he fights Steppenwolf, and what happens? He stops the axe and he's just like, not impressed. And he is completely in that moment. Daniel told me his wife, Fiza, said, she has never seen a hero more dripping in egoism. And I think that's a great way of saying it. In that moment, he is Superman. He is himself. And he is saying, this is what I'm doing. You can't beat me. I'm going to beat you. I'm not impressed. And I think it's so inspiring and awesome to see Snyder double down on that and not go away from that and even keep him wearing the black suit at the end. He's not a symbol at the end of this movie. He's just fighting for his values and what matters to him. He's not doing this because the world needs him. He's doing this because he's trying to understand how the world sees him and how he fits into it, but he's only fighting because he wants to, not because he has to. He even has a conversation with his mom that sort of follows up on Batman versus Superman, where he's like, you know, I'm not doing this because I have to. I want to know what's going on. I want to know why they brought me back. That's for his own gratification that he does that. That echoes the, you know, be their hero or be none of it. You don't owe this world a thing. He's not doing it because he owes the world. And it made me feel good and happy and safe with Zack Snyder that he was able to do that with Superman. What were your guys' thoughts on Superman? Did you have similar reaction?
Yeah, that I like your explanation of why the black suit, because at first when I was watching it, I didn't really understand why is he wearing the black suit? Why does he do that? But the idea, yeah, this is him not just wanting to be a symbol, makes a lot of sense. One thing
yeah,
I remember...
To be fair, I came to that through a conversation with Scott McClellan from the Suicide Squad cast. We did the Zack Snyder Bible stream together, and I asked him, in DC lore, what does he symbolize? And he talked a lot about that, and that's where I came to the formulation. Because there's also a quote from Snyder where he says, and I'm going to pull the quote up, from an Esquire magazine article where he says... I'm into this Robert Bly book, The Red, White, and Black, the white of naivete, the red of anger, and the black of humanity. And I think that, you know, when you hear him say, you hear him in his head before he takes flight again and chooses the suit, he hears his dad's talking to him. I think he's finally reconciled the two voices of Jonathan and Jor-El in his head. And I think that's why it's not symbolic anymore. It's not, he's not worried about what the world thinks of him like he was in Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, that makes sense. The other thing I was going to say is, I remember a big thing for me when we were talking about the theatrical release was, at that time, it was hard for me to understand, wait, why is Superman fighting them? And I had these two narratives or notions of it, that it was one, the sort of, I call it the feral idea. He's just brought back to life, he's disoriented, doesn't know what's going on, he's kind of like a wild animal lashing out at something that's a threat, versus the some idea or some conscious notion has changed, he's operating under a different ideology. And the problem I had with the first one, with the theatrical release, was if he's going to be in this feral, just fighting back, lashing out mode, it doesn't make sense for him to speak and particularly reference things that have been said before. That's, if he's at the level of a wild animal, he can't talk. If he had some change in his philosophy, ideology, then what is that? Why has he made that change? In the theatrical release, we didn't see any of that. And so that's why I liked in this one, he doesn't talk at all until, I guess, he's gone back to Kansas with Lois. And so it supports, in my mind, much more of that. He's kind of in a daze, fighting, reacting, people seem threatening to him. And then Lois brings him back to consciousness, to thought, reason, you know, back to a human level of understanding.
Yeah, I think I really liked that scene. I think that's another one that just couldn't have been done in a shorter format. It probably would have hit the cutting room floor, because otherwise it gives a bunch of space for that to happen, and it happens in a the whole meeting with talking to Lois, and then meeting with his mother, and then his decision. Like, it makes it all those steps deliberate.
Yeah, 100%. So the reason I set all this up is I think that this plays into the faith line. And I knew the faith line would be troublesome, especially for objectivist viewers. And I sort of want to call this segment our objectivist questions, because there's another good objectivist question later on. And there's two things to remember here. Is one, not every character in a movie has to be an objectivist character, even if there are objectivist underpinnings. And two, I don't think Snyder is a straight objectivist, nor do I think this is a straight objectivist movie. But what I think the faith thing is a reference to is all the way back in Man of Steel, where Superman doesn't know in the end what to do. Should he reveal himself? Should he fight to protect Earth? And he goes to the church, and the pastor says to him, sometimes you just have to take a leap of faith, and the trust part comes later. And this goes back to the Jor-El scene, where Jor-El says, you know, you can bring to them the belief that every person can be a force for good, which is ultimately, in my mind, a restatement of just individualism, right? And that's where it's important to say is people are neither good nor bad. People choose to be good or bad. And that's within this movie, right? We talked about Steppenwolf trying to take their free will, Darkseid trying to take their free will. And all these characters are choosing to be good and not choosing to be bad. And what Batman is saying, Bruce Wayne is saying, the two times he's talking to Alfred about it, is that he's not relying simply on empiricism. And I think a lot of people confuse reason with empiricism. It goes back to Batman versus Superman, where he says, you know, 20 years in Gotham, Alfred, how many good guys have there been? How many have stayed that way? This conversation is a direct reference to that. Because based on Batman's experience, William, based on Batman's experience, has he seen people be good, or has he just seen a bunch of people be killed and be terrible?
Yeah, he's seen the people who are good, like Robin, die, right? And and he's seen people who are good, like Harvey, turn evil.
Right. And we're reading that in. We haven't seen that in this universe, but we're well aware of the Harvey Dent story within the Batman mythos.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can almost watch the Batman... You can almost watch the Nolan trilogy and have it play into this, to be honest with you. It's very similar, right?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And we see a direct reference to that at the end with Joker, where he has to work with Joker. And it's almost like this trusting of Superman, and you see I've just seeded a word in there, this trusting of Superman can lead to him working with Batman. Because what Batman's really saying is, what Bruce Wayne is really saying is, he doesn't have faith in the religious sense. He's not turning off his mind. But he's saying, you know what? Ultimately, William, I have no way of knowing what you're going to do. I don't. Who's the only person who knows what you're going to do, William?
I should say me, but...
Right. But you could even argue it's not you. Nobody knows, right? Because you don't know until the exact moment you make the decision.
Until the moment I make the decision, yeah.
Right. So you don't know. So he doesn't know what Superman's going to do. He doesn't know that Superman's going to show up. It's impossible to know. Right now we're in an epistemological discussion here. So what he's saying is he has confidence. And I get that word from Midsider Michael, where he has confidence or trust. And, you know, an objectivist might have written this differently.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And use the word confidence or trust. But when he's saying he has faith that Superman can be a force for good and will choose to be a force for good because he believes in him. Belief and faith go together. And that's what he's saying when he uses that word. And that's what I think he means. And the thing I really appreciate about that is this is sort of Snyder redefining faith or defining it from sort of a humanistic point of view, because I think in this movie and in the trilogy, he's really discussing religion, where he talks about old gods and new gods. And Darkseid represents the old gods. And Steppenwolf represents the old gods. And we even say that, where I said earlier, down with the modern age, back to the Dark Ages. And, you know, Darkseid says, you know, the great darkness begins. And he tells the Amazons, like, it's all about your fear, right? You'll join the darkness with your fear. And the Amazons say, we have no fear, in a very Spartan moment, a very 300 moment.
Oh yeah.
And you know that's very similar. The Amazons versus Steppenwolf is very similar to the Spartans versus the Persians in 300. And I think that's very intentional on Snyder's part. So I think he's contrasting religion in that sense. And even if he's talking about religion and Christianity from and faith from a more humanistic standpoint, it's in a way that I'm comfortable with. And I'm okay with that. I'm not necessarily upset about.
Yeah, every movie doesn't need to be from exactly our identical philosophical premises to be good on its own terms and enjoyable and have messages worth taking heart of.
Right, and I don't think every character has to be as well. I don't think Batman. Yeah. Certainly with his PTSD and his trauma is going to be able to become a full-fledged objectivist, right? He's not going to be able to become a full-fledged egoist in Snyder's universe the way Superman is. I mean, look at Superman, right? He's the ideal hero in this universe, and he's much more of an egoist than Batman is in this universe. I would say he would say that Batman represents man and Superman represents the ideal man, which is very Randian in itself. He's just telling the story differently. He's telling the story from a perspective where man as man exists and man as ideal are one and the same, right? He's all, it's almost like Batman is Eddie Willers and Superman, this is really inside baseball here, but Superman is John Galt in this movie. It's almost like that. Or Batman's the wet nurse. Or how about this? I got a better one for you. Batman is Hank Reardon, and Superman is John Galt in this movie.
He has the potential, but flawed premises. Very disastrously flawed.
Right, and has gone through a bunch of bullshit because of it.
Yeah.
What do you think of all that, William?
Yeah, I can see the connections. I think Batman overall comes out of this with having the being the integrating character much more so than in the previous cut. And I think that the growth that all the characters go through like it gets back to what we were talking about before, is just given the room to breathe and be, right? I mean, forget, we had completely unmotivated characters before, or just sort of, I'm thinking specifically of the cyborg and his father relationship. Like the plot elements are the same, but the, you know, how Cyborg chooses to, you know, go on this journey and saying that at the end that I'm not broken, right? Because he was broken at the beginning, in the spiritual sense. And through joining...
Well, the physical sense, too. The car accident kind of, like, broke him in, like, a quarter of a person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, the first time we see him, it's not the car accident scene, right? But
right. I was just being funny.
Yeah, but so the first time we see him, he's broken, right? He's shut himself off from the world and thinks the world will reject him, and then he comes out the other side sort of not caring, in a sense. Well, you know, does the world reject me or not? That's not the important thing. The important thing is, you know, are there values for me to pursue, and am I pursuing them, right? And he's making those choices.
Well, doesn't he also say, I'm not broken and I'm not alone? And in the beginning, he was very much both, and now he's realized that actually he's neither. Or he, through his choices, became neither broken nor alone.
Yeah.
Right. And it's important that he says, I'm not broken first, because the only way he could be not alone is if he believed he wasn't broken.
Yes.
Right? It's not until Wonder Woman comes to him and tells him he has gifts. And he's like, gifts? What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, are you saying I can make animated videos on the internet because I'm a computer guy? Like, you said gifts with a T, right? Like, it's not until she says that and he understands, wait, I'm not a monster. These are gifts. Look at these amazing things I can do, that he accepts that, and then he starts helping, and then he realizes, wait, I'm not alone. There are other people who can do crazy shit like I can. So, and speaking of Cyborg... I think there's another question that's, it's more of a minor point, but I knew and I was hoping it wouldn't come up, but it's like, I watch these movies now to the point that, like, I know what people are going to say about anti or pro objectivism in these movies, blah, blah, blah. And there's another scene where Cyborg's first learning his powers, and in it, he sees a woman who is a good person, but she has a bad life, right? And when I say a bad life, like, she's suffering in a squalor she doesn't want, and the movie shows she doesn't deserve it. So Cyborg helps her when she's at a ATM, and he takes her money and multiplies it and makes it so she has $100,000 in her bank account. And the question was put in our Discord, and I would just want to read the question and then address it a little bit and share my thoughts and see what you all think of it. The question is, what do you all think about the idea that Cyborg's money scene is refuting Rand? In my limited understanding, it feels more like the opposite, because Cyborg's not necessarily going against his own values by doing what he did in that instance. So what he's referring to with going against Rand is the idea that he's basically stealing money or giving her unearned money, right? She didn't earn the money. He's just giving it to her. Now, there's a number of ways to look at this. First of all, saying that money in and itself is always moral is not objectively correct. People can have money that they don't deserve and not have money that they do deserve because the system can be flawed. And you could argue that Cyborg was saying, well, the overall system is flawed, so she deserves to have more money than she has. The other thing is, I like to call this the Cyborg doesn't understand inflation scene.
Yeah.
Where, look, we could, I think we can all agree that this woman probably should have a better life. She seems like a nice person, right? They don't show, Superman doesn't show her like hitting her kid or like killing someone, right? And it's very hard to say, like, okay, that woman has $100 in her bank account. If you could give her $100,000 instead, would you? It's not like he gave her $100 million and was like, here, now you're the richest, you're richer than Lex Luthor, right? Or you're here's $27 billion, you're richer than Amazon guy. Who's Amazon guy?
Bezos. Jeff Bezos.
He's not like he made her richer than Bezos, right? He gave her $100,000. So that shows he has maybe some awareness of like the unearned and inflation. But also, at what point is like you give this one woman $100,000? Is that really going to affect things negatively? I don't know. But then you get into a discussion of, well, how many people can we give $100,000 before we create inflation?
Yeah.
But I think the important thing is it was trying to establish as, and excuse me for mispronouncing this, Zhang Heili, I'm sorry, I know him as Punished Yellow Violin on Twitter, is saying he's not going against his own values. He's doing what he thinks is right. And that's the important thing. He's trying to figure out how to use his powers. Look, how many of us, if we're being honest, and I'm going to throw this question to you, Dan, if we're being honest and someone's like, you can control all computers throughout the world, how many of us aren't going to be like, hey, I'm going to give that person who's really cool some Bitcoin? That's sort of like an obvious first step when you're a college quarterback and you're 22, 23 years old and this is what happens to you. Like, you can see a young kid making that choice.
Yeah, certainly. And I think it's, especially given that it's early on, that maybe is part of his growth. Honestly, I want to see a solo Cyborg movie to really explore this, but I wondered if based on that there'd be some kind of scene of, you know, he realizes, wow, I could do this for everyone, there would be consequences, how do I decide who to help and in what ways without creating negative ripples? That is a whole separate question. But yeah, I think the initial idea would be, oh, cool, I could just give out something, and then only later do you realize, wait a minute, I'm either very randomly picking people to give this gift, or if I give it to everyone, then it has these dramatic unintended consequences.
Right, and William, to build off of what Daniel's saying, his father is saying to him, then you have to decide when to use your powers and when not to use your powers. And doesn't Snyder show him observing this woman for a long time before he makes this decision to give this to her?
Yeah, exactly. This is not some random person off the street, right? And it's sort of visually implied, I think, too, that it's someone in his neighborhood, so to speak, right? But, you know, it's... I think to what you're saying, Dan, like, it would be nice to have, you know, of all the characters, Cyborg's probably the one that I find the most interesting for, you know, maybe a standalone film. I mean, it's unfortunate, like, you compare it to what happens in the standalone films are often quite disappointing. I mean, look at Aquaman. I mean, that movie's terrible, right? And yeah. Like, the tone of Aquaman is wrong, and like,
especially after having seen this and how it was set up.
Yeah,
and then. And then, like, you know, thinking of the just the way that everything just happens, right? There's all plot conveniences in that. Things are telegraphed way too much. The whole MacGuffin of the Trident and the mother coming back. It's another one where the skeleton is not necessarily wrong of the story. But the way it's fleshed out is just wrong, right? You don't get to meet any of the other sort of Atlantean tribes or whatever you want to call them until the end. And you're like, wow, you could have done this way differently and introduced these things and make it so that we care about this, you know, random CGI character instead of it just being like, well, and then this is the last tribe that you're going to see, right? And that completes the picture. It's like, whoa, we could have had things. You could still keep the mother be the reveal, right? The payoff, but introduce these other characters in a way that gives them motivation and quote unquote character.
Yeah, I mean, I think skeletons is a great way of saying it, because when I watched Aquaman, I was like, wow, this is really the skeleton of a Snyder movie. Here's somebody stuck between two worlds. What's it mean to be stuck between two worlds? And what are those implications? But we never saw, like you said, the depth of it, the payoff of that. And I mean, it was even the same thing in that movie with the theatrical cut, to bend back to that, where there was a scene I was really relieved at early on. I don't know if anyone remembers in Aquaman where they were like, men are destroying the oceans, blah, blah, blah. Well, there was a thing in the theatrical cut, too, where Batman was trying to recruit Aquaman, and randomly it cuts to him talking about, like, the polar ice caps are melting. And Aquaman's like, I don't care, let them do it. That's fine by me. And it's like, why are we talking about environmentalism all of a sudden? None of that in the Snyder cut.
Yeah.
None of that. And I was just, when I saw that scene, I was like, yes, I knew it. I knew Snyder wouldn't do that.
Just to kind of throw that in there. Yeah, and I was an early part that stood out for me along with the Batman and Aquaman interaction that gave me a sigh of relief was they didn't have the "so I hear you can talk to fish" line in there. That was, again, one of the things I was worried about way back with the Whedon cut was these jokes that break up and undermine the serious moments, and having, you know, this serious intense confrontation, and then, oh, Batman doesn't really care, he's just gonna crack a joke, totally undermines it, and all of that was wiped away here.
Yeah, and to go in the opposite direction, something I was disappointed in one of the very, very early trailers, Batman had a line that said, Superman didn't just save people, he inspired them to be the best versions of themselves. Which he was talking about himself, right? And that idea is still in the movie. It's still shown through the way Batman acts, through the way Flash acts, through the way they all act. We still see that's the point, right? It's about being the best version of yourself. We still see that very Randian idea in there. But that line wasn't in the movie, and I was disappointed. I was waiting for it.
Yeah. That would have been a good one.
Other cool things from the movie. I thought it was really cool that Snyder sort of fleshed out what the rest of the arc would be. You know, the whole idea of Superman being Darkseid's general and mind controlled by him through the anti-life equation because Lois died. I thought it was really cool that they showed in Cyborg's vision Superman holding Lois's dead body and Darkseid, you know, consoling him. Not really, because we know Darkseid doesn't really care. Right, he's just pretending to. And then I thought it was really cool that was followed up on in the nightmare scene at the end with the scene with Joker. And I just want to, as a sort of a final thing before we get our final thoughts here, like, what did you guys think of that nightmare scene? Like, what did you guys think of Jared Leto as Joker? Because I was blown away by Jared Leto as Joker.
Yeah, I thought he did a great job. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it was channeling the best elements of the creepy Joker, which I love. Not actually love the Joker. I just love that, the kind of evil that can come out of that character. I think that that's one of the places where it was more dialogue driven, right? And it was just really revealing, like, what this nightmare really means to the world just by this interaction, And I thought that was really cool. I mean, one question I had, though, and maybe we can answer after Dan gives his impression, is the integrating it back with the where Barry goes back and says that that what does she say is like Lois is the key or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel like that's still a loose end.
Yep.
But anyway, let's get your impressions first before we dig into that one.
Yeah, I liked the all of what you could tell by had been happening in the background that led up to that conversation between Joker and Batman. I found that's the thing I like a lot in movies in general, is not just explaining, well, here's what happened. Lois died and Batman has survivor's guilt for things and, you know, they've kind of, you know, gotten an alliance. It, like, there's a, from the way they interact and the kinds of things they say, you can tell, you can infer a lot of what must have gone on to lead to that point without just having a narrative dump on that. And you can figure out stuff about their relationship, what Joker is trying to do, like, especially when Batman brings up, oh, when Harley Quinn died, she told me to kill you. And Joker seems at first taken aback by that, or actually genuinely distraught by it, but then either decides Batman is lying or his psychosis takes over and he's like, oh no, actually I don't really care. And so you could see the inner turmoil inside Joker as well as the manipulative malevolence.
Yeah, like I said, the Jared Leto's performance, just wow. Like, there's one thing I want to see more of in this movie, it's Jared Leto's Joker. I just, wow.
Which is funny, because given how much flack he took for his Joker in Suicide Squad.
I liked him in Suicide Squad. I liked him. I think the Ayer cut's a foregone conclusion at this point.
For Suicide Squad?
Oh, you don't know?
Oh, no, I haven't been following up. I haven't been keeping track of
David
this stuff.
David Ayer shot a different movie that was released in theaters.
Oh, interesting. Of course.
This was much more done than Snyder's version was, though. And he wasn't fired. Like, he stayed on the production. It's a much different situation, but I still think they'll release it because they'll see there's a lot more Joker in it. They took a lot of the Joker out of the Suicide Squad theatrical cut because they were trying to make Harley and Joker's relationship more marketable than abusive, like it typically is.
Mm.
Okay, so William, to answer your question, what is the loose end you're seeing in regard to Barry and Lois and Batman and Bruce Wayne?
Well, just that we don't see Barry, we haven't seen Barry do it yet, right? Like, okay. I thought maybe that would be what we saw there, right? In
okay,
the nightmare
so you're,
scene.
You're saying the loose end is that we haven't seen it. You know what happens.
Yeah, exactly. We know he, at some point, he goes back and does that. And he says, oh, am I too early, right?
Right.
But we haven't seen it play out in forward time yet.
Certainly. And I mean, there is more movie to show if you want to show it. And, you know, that's a personal preference whether you want to see those movies or not. I'm satisfied. Like, I know where those are going to go. I know where the movie is. Like I said, I feel safe with how Superman's going to portray how Zack Snyder's going to portray Superman now, right? He's going to show him being more comfortable. You know, first he's going to show him being a villain because he gets taken over by Darkseid. Then he's going to come back and be more comfortable being that symbol because he's going to understand what it was like to be the symbol of evil. So he's going to want to be the symbol of good. I get all that. I'm fine with it. Like, if he wants to show it and make the movie, I'm down. I'll watch it. I don't need to, though. I get it. I get what's going to happen. I understand this story so well at this point that I know what's going to happen. And that's what I was wondering. So you guys are clear on what happens, right? That they go and they get the mother box that helps Barry travel back in time, and he warns Bruce so Bruce can... You know what Bruce does?
No.
What do you... Yeah.
Okay. So what happens is Superman asks Batman to protect Lois. Darkseid comes in and kills Lois. He could have stepped in front of the beams and had Lois live. Lois dies. Superman turns evil. The anti-life equation is used on Superman because he has no sense of self anymore. And he becomes Darkseid's minion and they take over Earth. So Batman gets Barry to travel back in time and tell him, you have to save Lois. Lois is the key. That's why Joker says to Batman, how many times is this going to continue because you are not willing to die? And just like Superman and Batman versus Superman died fighting for his values, Batman's going to do that.
Okay.
That makes sense. Was that the question you had?
Yeah.
Yeah, that right. perfectly makes sense. One thing I was observing from Lois dies and so Superman turns evil is it kind of raises the question of to what extent is he really back and kind of all better from his fighting with the rest of the Justice League right after he gets revived. Is he on sort of that narrow of a thread that Lois getting killed, which obviously would be terrible and devastating, is not just he's crushed and devastated, but he decides, nah, screw it all, I'm gonna destroy the world. Or maybe it's just he's shaken enough that the anti-life equation can mind control him, or Darkseid through whatever means can mind control him. But it part of where my head went is, yeah, that his grasp on the world is sort of that tenuous that this one thing radically changes him.
Well, I think it's important what you just said, that it's the anti-life equation that also seduces him, right? It's not just like, oh, Lois died. Okay, I'll join you, Darkseid, right? He doesn't like flip like that. It's what makes him susceptible. And now I've never lost somebody on that level. You know, I've gone through breakups and things like that, but like the grief of someone dying, I don't know. I mean, again, Snyder can speak more to that personally with the tragedy that happened to his daughter. This whole movie was for Autumn, right? Yeah. That said at the end, for Autumn, that was for his daughter. But it's the when you have that level of grief or you have some sort of a loss, right? I mean, I can even speak to losing in sports, right? You lose yourself a little bit because it's like, what am I fighting for? What am I doing? What are my values? Do I have the right values? Why is the world so cruel? Right? Is life good? Can I be happy? Is happiness possible? That's what tragedy does to you. That's what grief does to you. It makes you answer those questions. And then someone comes along and uses the anti-life equation on you, which the anti-life equation is an actual equation. I don't know what the actual words are, but this is like a DC thing, right?
Yeah.
Go look at what the actual equation is. That plays into him being at his weakest moment. Because also think about it from a symbolic storytelling standpoint. This is my world. You are my world. You know, he is saying this is my world and he does have values, but we're showing that concretely in the abstract, which is a weird way to say it, is Lois. It's a story. Yeah, in real life, like, one person dies and you don't want someone to commit suicide over it and think their life is over. But if that happens in real life and then we have a story where everything is exaggerated and romanticized, well, of course it's going to make him that vulnerable.
Yeah. One thing that what you said just now made me think of is comparison to General Zod, where once back in Man of Steel, that when Superman destroys the world engine and so Zod's world is destroyed, Zod then just becomes totally malevolent and just wants to see everything burn. And so it could be a parallel to Superman, that when his world gets destroyed, he in some way turns malevolent and just kind of wants to see things burn.
Well, that's all the villains in the movies. I mean, yeah, Zod, like, he's got a fucked up premise, right? And he believes fucked up things. But there's a level of humanity in Zod where he believes his life purpose has been taken away, so he's going to just fuck everything up and just kill Superman. Like, you get that.
Right? Yeah.
You don't agree with it, but you're like, yeah, I get why he would do that.
Yeah.
It's the same thing here with Steppenwolf, right? I mean, the scene that's being memed is where Desaad tells Steppenwolf, you're going to have to get 50,000 more worlds, and you just see, like, Steppenwolf's about to cry. In that moment, you know, he's still, like, a mass-murdering asshole, but you're still like, oh, man, Steppenwolf, like, I get where you're coming from.
He just wants
to
go home.
Agree with him. Right, he just wants to be loved, man. And it's the same thing with Zod, right? Like, Zod ultimately just wants to be loved, but neither of them have self-love. And it's even the same thing with Lex Luthor, right? Like, you get why Lex Luthor went insane. He completely lost his sense of self because he felt like he wasn't equal to Superman, and he had to kill the god in order to make himself important again. So I do think it all sort of has that parallel on purpose. So I think it's very smart of you to point that out. Okay, let's sum this episode up. Any final thoughts on Zack Snyder's Justice League? William?
Well, I think that you should see this movie. I think that it will keep you entertained. There are, even if you're not a huge DC Comics fan, things will make sense. These characters are iconic. There are things that you might miss, some fan services you might miss, but overall, this will engage you with some deep philosophical ideas, which is ironic because it's a kid's comic book.
Dan?
Yeah, one thing I can just leave us with that I didn't point out earlier is that there was not a much exploration of how the average person was reacting to this, to the degree you had with Batman v Superman, which not so much a criticism as interesting, but overall, yes, absolutely. See this movie. I need to watch it again to process it more. I think there's a lot for anyone and everyone here. And, it's just amazing to see a particularly modern superhero movie have actual content behind it. Unlike a lot of what goes on in the Marvel movies, which are more just kind of fun.
And to build on what both of you are saying, I don't think we should allow ourselves to be limited to, oh, this is a comic book movie, so I'm not going to like it. Or this is a comic book movie, so it's going to be a certain way. Sometimes there are movies that transcend their genres. And I think both Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman did. But I think more than the other two, Justice League is a movie anyone can watch. It doesn't matter if you're a comic book movie fan or not. More than any other comic book movie, I think it transcends the genre. And it's like, you know, let's take Crazy Rich Asians, for instance. And whoever on their bingo card had Justin compare Zack Snyder's Justice League to Crazy Rich Asians, you win. But look, Crazy Rich Asians is a romantic comedy, right? I don't usually like those kind of movies. There's a bit of drama thrown in there as well. It's not really a movie I would like, but it is a very well done movie, and it transcends the genre. And that's why it was such a cultural force, and it's been so influential. Now, people are taking the wrong things from it, right? And they're taking, oh, we need to cast more Asians and things. I'm not personally going to disagree with that for personal reasons. But apparently everyone, I thought that was funnier than everyone else did. Hopefully somebody out there in the mid-side audience laughed. But
I got it.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. But yeah, it's a movie. Look, I would say you should see Crazy Rich Asians. If you get a chance, see it. It's a good movie. It is a genuinely good movie. Is it your style? Maybe not. But you should see it. I'm not going to tell you to see every horror comedy movie because that's just a genre I prefer. But when I say you should see Happy Death Day, see it. Because it transcends the genre. But Freaky, that doesn't transcend the genre. Do I enjoy it? Do I think it's a good movie? Yeah, but I'm not going to say you should definitely see that movie. But yeah, see Happy Death Day. That transcends the genre. Right? Sometimes there are movies that transcend the genre. And this movie, Zack Snyder's Justice League, is one. Because it speaks to, and something I had been saying leading up to the movie and its release is, it speaks to what's going on in our society. We're kind of living in a Batman versus Superman world right now. We all don't like ourselves, right? We all have problems with ourselves. We're all very collectivistic. We're hateful towards each other. We don't have that belief in the goodness of other people, right? We don't have that faith that Bruce Wayne has in Justice League. But it's all answered by what Cyborg says. I'm not broken, and I'm not alone. Even if you just repeat those things as a mantra to yourself, your life will get a million times better. Reinforce those to yourself every morning. I'm not broken, and I'm not alone. Those statements alone will cure you of a victim complex, will cure you of loneliness, will make you more likely to interact with other people, because you will see other people as striving to achieve their values in a way that you never have before. You know, William said he didn't like the word faith. Have that confidence in other people. Or, and this is a controversial word within objectivism too, this is really inside baseball, have that benevolence. Am I saying benevolence is a primary virtue? No. Find your reason, find your purpose, find your self-esteem, right? That's what we're really saying. Find your self-esteem, then you can have that benevolence. You can have that confidence. You can have that, in the words of Zack Snyder's Justice League, you can have that faith that when you wave the red cape, it charges back. I would like to thank William and Daniel for joining me on this discussion. Dan Hackney, Trailer Takedown Dan, and joining me in this discussion for Zack Snyder's Justice League. It was tremendous. I thought we hit on a lot of good points. I thought we hit it from an objectivist angle, which I think is super important to get that review out there and that content out there. As always, I would like to thank you, the listeners, for listening to this, for always wanting to hear what we have to say about Zack Snyder movies. I had people reaching out to me on Twitter, of all places, saying, when are you going to talk about the movie? When's your review going to be? Holy crap, people actually want to hear what I want to say on it now? I thought people were sick of me. I thought people were sick of saying, here's the individualism in these movies. But if you, Dan, if people don't see the individual in Zack Snyder's Justice League, they're nuts, right?
I don't know how you could sustain that. I thought it was obvious enough in Man of Steel when Zod has a literal speech about it, but especially after this one.
Well, yeah, and then in Batman versus Superman, there was the whole sacrifice argument. But there's no argument in this one. What do you think, William?
Yeah, I think it has evolved, right, over time. And we're seeing, and this is just the concrete manifestation of it.
Right, we're finally seeing the payoff. So thank you to everyone who wanted to hear that. Appreciate that. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you want more, let me know. We'll talk about it some more. Thank you, as always, to our libertarian listeners. We appreciate you, Liberty.me, for syndicating us. Hopefully, libertarian listeners, when we take a detour into a more art-based conversation like this, you see the connection and you see the value of individualism and celebrating it in romantic art in relation to freedom and limited government. Hopefully you get that. I hope I communicate that enough to you. As always, if you want to support the show, you can join our Discord channel. You can keep the conversation going. We had that great question in Discord. We were all thinking of it. We all saw the We all saw the scene, and we were like, man, Cyborg does not understand inflation, does he? At all. We all saw that. We all thought it. So it's important that we brought it up. So thank you to Punished Yellow Red Violin for bringing that up in Discord. You can support us on Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode. Locals is per month. You can do that in themidside.com/Patreon and themidside.com/Locals. And as always, the number one way you can support the show is tell a friend. If you enjoyed this conversation about Zack Snyder's Justice League, if you think it's different than what's out there, let people know. Tell them about us. Right? We just had a very long conversation for a very long time about Batman versus Superman. That conversation is about to happen with Zack Snyder's Justice League. Let's frame this the right way now. Let's let people know about the individualism in this movie. Let's let people know about Superman being an egoist in this movie. Let's not let them frame it the way they did before. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have an individualistic faith day. Be back, just be a total bad. Find the matter's most to you.
We live in a society.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
Guess we're going back to Glenn, the old standby. Stop Asian hate. Stop Asian hate by turning Glenn into a drop. How dare you?
Oh, my.
I didn't know he was Asian.
That's how not racist we are on the midside.
/ I haven't seen that show.